Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. It has been 60 years since the Holocaust and the death of an estimated 11 million people, 6 million of them Jews. Nazi occupation forces ravaged Poland, Austria, Belgium, France, Norway, parts of Russia, Yugoslavia, and many other countries. The Nazis' Nuremberg Laws of 1935 were designed to keep Jews out of every facet of public life. Jews were stripped of citizenship, property, and the basic right to life. More than 1 million children were killed either in death camps or the violence, and an estimated two-thirds of European Jews died.
You were so hungry that you would just eat everything.
At USC's Shoah Foundation Institute, Ishak Goldblatt spoke of the tremendous hunger in the camps.
But we were so religious that even after the war, when we ate those conserves, those cans of meat, and it was not kosher, it was whatever it was. We didn't even know what it was. We didn't care what it was. But I would make a blessing in my mind, I would make a blessing, because we make a blessing before eating something and after eating something, because the Talmud has it that everything belongs to God. And if you take something without saying a blessing, then you are kind of stealing from God, and you can't do that. So you say the blessing, by the blessing you acquire it, and it belongs to you, and then you can eat it.
U.S. soldier Paul Park spoke of the way a young girl responded to him and remembered him after meeting her at Dachau.
I talked with this woman who was a child, a young child, and I told her who I was. I was on my knees talking to her, and I told her my name, and, you know, it was just a nice kid who was just, and she wasn't in too good a shape, but she was in better shape than most of them for some reason, and we talked, and it was over. One day I was in Boston here, and I went to a meeting of the survivors, but this woman screamed and ran over to me and said, "I know you, I know you, I know you." And I'm saying, "This woman doesn't know me at all. What is she talking about?" And she identified herself as the little girl I talked to at Dachau. And I was just amazed how she would remember me. She said, "I know you by your eyes."
You can find many online testimonies from Shoah, Holocaust survivors, and others at the University of Southern California's Shoah Foundation Institute for Visual History and Education in Los Angeles, California. And we'll link to it on our website, talknationradio.org. We're joined by Alice Rothschild, a Boston OBGYN doctor and assistant professor at Harvard Medical School. She's the successful daughter of a largely Orthodox Jewish family. The history of the Holocaust had profound meaning in her life, and in her book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience, she writes, "I was born in Boston, Massachusetts in 1948 to first-generation parents, and grew up with the State of Israel as my friend, my pride, and ultimately my heartbreak." Rothschild devoted her life to helping the poor and underserved communities of Massachusetts, but what she learned about the Vietnam War taught her to look more deeply, even at the U.S. military that had rescued Jews from the death camps. That step took her ultimately to a long journey of exploration of Israeli history, and she's now working on a film about the year of her birth and beyond, Israel's birth and its profound consequences for both Jews and Palestinians of various religious backgrounds, like the ones she has met in her travels to both Israel and Palestine. We spoke with Dr. Alice Rothschild just after her return from Israel and Palestine in January of 2010. Her blog entry, January 9th, 2010, reads, "Take me back to my homeland, even as a rose." Today in Israel, a center for culture and science, medicine and high tech, religious revival and literature, famous nature reserves and gorgeous beaches. I learned how to step across coils of barbed wire. It is critical to walk cautiously, to place your foot firmly at the intersection of several coils simultaneously, to avoid the spring-like action in the wire, or the grip of the rows of sharp knife points waiting like shark's teeth for a hapless victim. Rothschild crossing the border into Palestine, going through checkpoints with Palestinians. She writes January 13th, living in hell. On January 12th, we drive to the southern West Bank city of Hebron. The city is literally drowning in a complex, traumatic, and violent history that has given birth to the outrageous situation we see today. I asked Dr. Rothschild to talk about what it was like to go back again.
I find it always challenging to return year after year because the situation seems to get worse every year. It's really challenging to keep going back and feeling like progress is not being made. The thing that I find is that my role is best as an observer, as someone who's bearing witness, as someone who's working in solidarity with Jewish Israelis and Palestinians who are willing to speak with each other and work together, but it's still a pretty overwhelming trip.
Certainly, there has been a deepening of this crisis over the past few months in light of Israel's refusal to freeze settlements.
Right. The stuff that's going on in East Jerusalem is extremely painful and disturbing. I mean, it's been going on for years, but it's accelerating. And basically what we see is an attempt to bring Jewish settlers into East Jerusalem and to make it impossible for East Jerusalem to be a future capital of a Palestinian state. So it's a process that is called Judaization. And you see this in Hebron, you see this in East Jerusalem, you see it in many places where Palestinians live, either in Israel or in the West Bank. And it's a process that makes you wonder, are the people in charge really thinking about a two-state solution, or are they thinking about a greater Israel that with an apartheid Palestine, you know, in little cantons in the middle? And at this point, these people that work in civil society and nonviolent resistance, the tone that I found talking to different people was that, you know, wars have been useless, the UN has been fairly useless, legal challenges have been useless, you know, protests have been useless. I mean, there's not anything that has actually worked, and people are really turning to the movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And so that's where all the focus was in terms of working for social change, that people have really given up on, quote, the peace process, because it's not really a process moving towards peace. There is that sense that you get when you're there and talking to the kind of people that I was talking with.
And then there was the couple, the physicians,
right,
who are leaving Palestine.
Right, right. One of the difficulties is that it is very, very hard to live there. And so this is a couple that I've known for many years. I knew the woman when she was a medical student, and she did an exchange program with Harvard University and her university, Al-Quds University in Jerusalem. And she has had years of training in dialogue and reconciliation. She's been in the camp Seeds of Peace. I mean, she's done all the right things, you know, and she's very articulate and knowledgeable. And to see her journey as a medical student and as a physician, it has been incredibly painful for me because it's partly a reflection of the political situation. So, you know, she wanted to get a residency, and there are no really high-level residencies in the occupied territories, and Israel doesn't recognize her medical degree, although Harvard University recognized her medical school. So she attempted to go to Beirut, and there was a war, so she didn't go. So then she got a master's at Brandeis in international health management. And then she tried again to go to Beirut and found the hostility towards Palestinians in her residency so overwhelming that she decided that she wasn't going to put up with it. And you know, her husband is has been a physician for many years and is a very smart, articulate guy. He's been, you know, head of departments. He's trained in the UK. I mean, he's the kind of doctor you'd want. And he's had an immense amount of difficulty either working in the Israeli medical system because he's from East Jerusalem, so he can do that because he feels like he's working with the oppressor. And then when he's working in the Palestinian system, the Palestinian healthcare system is in chaos because the Ministry of Health is working under occupation, you know, it's underfunded, there are multiple NGOs. I mean, it's not an easy place to work. And basically, the two of them have just had a baby, and they've decided that they cannot stand this anymore. And they actually talk about, he actually talks about having a feeling of PTSD, that he just cannot tolerate one more checkpoint, one more barrier, you know, one more Israeli invasion. He just cannot do it. And so they're trying to emigrate to Australia. And, you know, he said this is that he's not giving up and that this is a form of resistance to not be destroyed by the process of occupation. But, you know, it's part of the tragedy of the whole situation.
Dr. Alice Rothschild, what are you going to be working on as you, you know, try to help people understand what your trip was like and what you took in there? What do you see in the near future for the work that you've been doing?
The thing that I came away from is, first of all, a tremendous desire to write about this and to describe to people what we saw. I mean, I worked in medical clinics. I saw patients. I visited families. You know, I had a lot of personal experience with people living under occupation and also living in Israel as second-class citizens. And I think just bearing witness and writing and talking about what we saw and did is important. The other thing is that I began to really understand how important it is for us to be working on the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement, that at this point, everything else has failed. And I think that it behooves us as activists, as people who are interested in a solution to this conflict that involves justice and human rights and international law, that the main player right now is BDS. And so that is much clearer to me. So as an activist, what I'm going to try to do with my own activist community is figure out how do we engage in that. The other thing that I'm working on is a documentary film where I've interviewed Palestinians about their family stories of 1948, what happened, and all the subsequent consequences of the establishment of the State of Israel. And the reason I'm working on that particular project is that I think that, you know, for a long time we would say, well, if we could only end the occupation, everything would be okay. And one of the things that I've sort of come to understand better is that while I fully understand, you know, the Holocaust and the founding of the State of Israel and all the sort of political and emotional and religious and all the forces that went into that, there is a tremendous flaw in the concept of a Zionist Jewish state, in that people talk about a democratic Jewish state. I mean, you can't have those two words in the same sentence. And it's become very clear to me that we need to go back and look at what happened in 1948 and then see how all the issues that have arisen since then come from this basic foundations of the state, and really ask ourselves, if we're really interested in Jews being safe and living healthy lives and all the things that we would like, we also really need to look at what were the consequences of the founding of the State of Israel, and does the fact that there is a Jewish state, is that really better for Jews or not? And what could the future hold if we took off our blinders and stepped out of the box? And so I think that I'm going to be exploring that whole issue as well, you know, using personal stories and trying to help people see Jews and Palestinians as equal people with aspirations and history and rights and all the things that would make a world a better place to live in.
Palestinians have played a big role. It seems as if more and more relationships have been created between Palestinians and Americans and other international activists interested in this part of the world.
I think that in the Palestinian community, you know, people don't hear about this stuff, but there's a long history of boycotting Israeli products, of you know, rallies and protests. I mean, this is all, gatherings like this are all illegal under occupation, but Palestinians do it over and over again. You know, every Friday there's a gathering in the town of Beilin to protest the wall, and it's nonviolent protesters, and then they get shot at and tear gassed by Israeli soldiers. This happens every Friday. There's a lot of nonviolent protesting that goes on all the time. And I think that the BDS movement is also, the call went out from Palestinian civil society organizations. These organizations have been the brains behind this movement. And so I think we take the inspiration from the Palestinians who are making this call. So that's something that the intellectual work is being done by Palestinians who are involved in this movement. Within Israel, there's actually a small group of Israelis who are supporting the BDS movement within Israel because they feel like at this point, it's the only thing left, that pressure needs to be put on Israel from the rest of the world because everything else has failed. But most Israelis, I don't think about this much. It's not on their minds.
What about partnership on the Palestinian side, you know, toward increasing human rights and bringing about a peaceful solution?
It was made very clear to me by a number of Palestinians that they don't want to be seen as a victimized charity case. That Palestinians have a vibrant, nonviolent civil society movement. People are very involved in organizations such as Adamir, which looks at prisoners and prison rights, and Badil, which looks at refugee rights, and Palestinian Medical Relief Society, which does healthcare and empowerment. I mean, there's a lot of Palestinian work that's done that people want other people to engage with them, but not to pity them or not to look at them as the constant victim, because it's a very resilient society. And that's what's so impressive about talking with people. And, you know, most of the Palestinians that I dealt with, you know, are fairly disgusted with Fatah and Hamas and really would like to move forward and are much far ahead of their leadership. And people, you know, we're not talking one state, two state. We're talking about how can we move forward with human rights being recognized for Palestinians, and that that's the issue, and that the way to get there is through boycott, divestment, and sanction movement that, you know, has to be mostly from the outside world, because that's how pressure will be put to change the behavior of the Israeli government.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio. Over the past few months, there has been a mobilization of groups interested in ending the Israeli and Egyptian blockade of Gaza. As more and more rights groups joined them in this call, they too found themselves blockaded. And groups like Oxfam International, Save the Children, Doctors Without Borders, the Religious Society of Friends, and others have found themselves unable to get work permits from the Israeli government to work in Gaza. It's part of a growing crackdown on critics by the Netanyahu government, but it may be resulting in a backlash. 54 members of the U.S. House of Representatives have signed a letter to President Obama. It says, quote, "The unabated suffering of Gazan civilians highlights the urgency of reaching a resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we ask you to press for immediate relief for the citizens of Gaza as an urgent component of your broader Middle East peace." The effort is led by Congressman Ellison of Minnesota and McDermott from Washington State. Also for the first time, a member of Connecticut's Congress, Representative Jim Himes, is supporting the call to end the Israeli siege of Gaza. Bradley Burstyn, a Haaretz correspondent, reported on calls from retired Israeli military officials for another Gaza war, something he was taking very seriously. Bradley Burstyn had called on President Barack Obama to intervene. We asked Dr. Alice Rothschild what she would make of that possibility.
I was hopeful that Obama would confront Netanyahu on the settlement issue, and it looked like he was going to do that, and then they had their little tussle, and it looks like, I mean, I don't know what goes on in the halls of power, but it does look like Obama blinked first. And I think that's a very dangerous sign, because Netanyahu hasn't been tamed at all. I don't know what would happen. And the idea of another attack on Gaza, when Gaza is in such severe distress, it's stunning. You know, it's a stunning concept.
Israel in 2009 bombed tunnels in Gaza. This is happening again in 2010, but also I understand there were tunnels flooded by Israeli forces.
The issue about the tunnels, I mean, this is why people aren't starving to death, is that there are tunnels that bring in food and cows and all the things that the society needs, because they're completely blockaded. So it's a pretty desperate place. I don't know what finish the job means when it's a pretty finished place already. So, again, I can't speak for the halls of power, but I think Gaza's already devastated.
We've seen two things happen in the past month. One, of course, the fact that the Gaza Freedom March was stopped in Egypt.
Right. A
lot of internationals gathering in Egypt, some of them treated in a very heavy-handed way,
right,
by police in Egypt, in the streets of Egypt, and some of them beaten up.
Right.
But ultimately, the question would be about what came out of all of that. And it seems as if a lot of the non-governmental organizations that have worked in Palestine and Gaza have started to combine their voice behind peace activists trying to end the blockade. They've paid a heavy price in that the Israelis have now prevented them from doing work in Gaza.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just talk about that a little bit as someone who truly understands the impact that social workers and doctors and human rights workers can make in these places?
The impact is kind of obvious. You know, Gaza was severely damaged during the war. It wasn't in good shape before the war. And now, I mean, people can't rebuild their houses because concrete is not allowed across the Israeli checkpoint. I mean, the list of things that are not allowed is appalling. And so this is a society that's fairly desperate. And the medical system is barely functional, and they don't have equipment, and they don't have medication. And the blockade is crushing people. So I see the failure of the Gaza Freedom March and the big brouhaha over the Viva Palestina convoy and the continued blockade as all part of that same just starving Gaza to death. And it sounds very blunt, but this is a desperate place. And I don't understand why leaders in the rest of the world are not more concerned about this, because, when people get desperate, they do desperate things. And it's not to anybody's benefit to keep people that subjugated and that poverty-stricken and that much in need of basic social services, and also unable to rebuild from the catastrophe that just happened.
Could you describe Palestine, Hebron, the places you saw, for listeners who might not have any concept of what it's like there? I think in many cases, we are influenced by the portraits drawn for us by the limited news media on mm-hmm. this part of the world.
The West Bank, different places are very different depending on whether they're a city or whether they're a village, what kind of access there is. For instance, when I entered the West Bank, I went to the Kalandia checkpoint. And this is sort of when you get the sense that you're in a prison, because it's a big terminal. There are four turnstiles that you have to go through that are these sort of narrow turnstiles where you can't fit in with your suitcase, and everybody's pushing and shoving. And there's one Israeli soldier who's deciding yes, no. The tension builds as people wait. The turnstiles can be turned on, turned off. You go through this kind of thing, and you get the sense that you're entering a jail. When I went through the checkpoint in Bethlehem, again, that's a huge terminal. Again, very intimidating. I found when I went into Bethlehem, I didn't have any trouble. When I went out of Bethlehem, I spent an hour at a turnstile with an ever-increasing line of people because the soldiers had decided to only let one person through about every 5 minutes. So the quirkiness of the checkpoint system and when you can get through easily and when you can't means that your whole life is unpredictable. You can never say to someone, oh, I'll meet you at such and such, because you never know if you'll get through or how long you'll get through. In Bethlehem, where I spent some time, the city, which used to be a huge Christian city with all these religious centers and a center of tourism, is pretty devastated by the wall. And in Bethlehem, the separation wall is concrete. It's 8 meters high. It's covered with graffiti that just makes you want to cry or scream. And the wall snakes all through Bethlehem, so you can't get away from it. And in Bethlehem, there's the city, and then there are three refugee camps. So the refugee camps are refugees from 1948 and their descendants. And the refugee camp I spent time in was the Ida refugee camp, which is about 4,000 people in a very small space. More than half of them are under 18. There's very little employment. People are doing the best they can. There's a UN school that has 40, 50 kids in a class. There's UN medical facilities. Again, an overworked healthcare staff with not enough supplies. There's a lot of local ingenuity in the Ida camp. There's an incredible center called the Al-Ghawad Children's Theater, where they teach dance and theater and drama and for kids, and they have women's embroidery and yoga classes and all sorts of cultural things to engage the youth and the women in the camp so that they have productive ways to do what they call beautiful resistance. So this center is very inspiring. It's also desperately in need of funds. People work very hard to make it happen. And in the camp, some people live in pretty crowded conditions with multiple generations and several rooms, and there's no room for more building. Other people have nicer apartments that they built over time. It's not a planned community because it started out as UN tents and then things kind of built up around it. Again, it's a very different experience than being in the city of Bethlehem. If you're in Ramallah, which is a very major city, it feels very urban and sort of like a third world urban city. But if you're leaving Ramallah and you want to go north, you can't go the direct way. You have to go on what's called the container road because Palestinians are not allowed on the more direct roads. So you end up having to spend a lot of time on a road that goes through mountains and has all these hairpin turns and is not well paved, you know, thinking, oh God, am I going to live through this experience? And this is because you're in a Palestinian taxi, you know, and if you had Israeli license plate, you could go a whole different straight way that wouldn't take this long. So you see how the impact of being occupied is always present. The other thing I did was I visited a number of destroyed villages where in 48 or in 67, the Palestinians were run out of villages, the villages were destroyed. And in the West Bank, you can visit villages that the people can't go back to. And in Israel, the Israelis have taken over the land. The Jewish National Fund has planted trees to cover it up. And you have people who can see where their grandfather's home was, but they live a couple of miles away in a new village that they had to make after 48 or 67. So this whole sense of what happens when a state privileges Jews over everybody else and what are the consequences of that political decision are very painful and apparent. So that's sort of a taste of what it's like. I mean, in Hebron, it's probably the ugliest because you have very, very right-wing settlers living on top of Palestinians. And these settlers have basically destroyed the lives of many, many Palestinians living in Hebron. And the soldiers defend the settlers. And so the settlers are the kind of people who throw trash and feces and urine and bricks on Palestinians in the marketplace. So the Palestinians have put up a wire, a mesh over their market so that they can engage in business and not get hit with the stuff from the settlers. I mean, it's crazy, crazy behavior. And, you know, the thing about settlers like that, who are the most racist, fascist element, you know, most Israelis don't support them, but they get full support from their government. They get full protection from the Israeli defense forces. You know, when we were there, we saw two episodes where Israeli soldiers sort of were really harassing Palestinian boys and, you know, had them pinned down. And you thought, this is daily life in Hebron, you know. So in a city like that, the occupation is very brutal and very raw. I visited a Palestinian who the street in front of his house is now closed to Palestinians. Only Jews can walk on it, and so he can't get into his house. So he has to go via backyards and over people's gardens and things to get into the back door of his house because he can't go in the front door. I mean, this is crazy, but, you know, this is what his life is like. And there is a very rabid anti-Palestinian Jewish settler who lives right above him who throws trash down and, you know, comes in and beats him up. And, you know, I mean, it's crazy, crazy, crazy. And this is the outgrowth of the occupation of tolerating and supporting these kind of right-wing settlers. Again, most Israelis don't think much about this. They don't particularly support them, but they don't understand how dangerous this is and how settlers like this are used as a wedge to grab more land, to take more control. I mean, they're Judaizing Hebron, and that's what they're doing, and they have the full support of the Israeli government. And so it's totally painful to be in that setting, although you meet a lot of very fine Palestinians who are nonviolent, who are continuing to struggle to live there, who are trying to keep their case in front of the international eyes, but it goes on.
Just say more, finally, about what's happening to the children of Gaza.
The children in Gaza are much worse off than the children in the West Bank, so it's two whole different worlds that these children live in. But Palestinian children have, in general, first of all, witnessed a large amount of violence. You know, many have seen their houses demolished or have seen Israeli attacks. Many, many children have seen their parents humiliated at checkpoints. I mean, there's a whole psychological trauma that goes along with living under occupation. And the issue of food security kind of depends on what year you're talking about, but, you know, the Palestinian economy is not good. And again, Gaza is much, much, much worse than the West Bank. So the food issue depends on where the child is. Are they urban? Are they rural? Do the parents have work? Do they live in a camp? Do they live in a village? What are all the issues that go into nutrition? But again, it's a very difficult place to be a child, and more than half the population are children.
Dr. Alice Rothschild of American Jews for a Just Peace. You can find her book online at alicerothschild.com, and we'll link to it on our website, talknationradio.org. The book, Broken Promises, Broken Dreams, Stories of Jewish and Palestinian Trauma and Resilience. It's published by Pluto Press, and an updated version should be available by March. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. I'm Dori Smith.